Well, good evening, everyone, from Washington, D.C. Welcome to another Chela Town Hall meeting. I want to thank those of you who have already joined this phone call and encourage you to stick with us. We're going to be taking some questions here in a few minutes, but it's truly a great honor to have you tonight as we talk about the goings-on in our nation's capital, and there's a lot of things to talk about tonight. I do these Teletown Hall meetings on occasion to kind of keep my finger on the pulse of what's on the hearts and minds of those in the community that I serve here in Washington. And I want to thank you for joining tonight, for adjusting to the date change. We were going to do this last night, and some weather moved in, and it started snowing, and we ended up with about 6 inches of snow on the ground. So late afternoon, we released our team and went home for the night and came back with the intent of having our Teletown Hall this evening. So I'm glad to be bringing it to you, even though it is a day later than scheduled. For those listening on their phones, you can press *3, that's *3, to get in the queue to ask a question, to sign up for our newsletter, *6. We put out a newsletter every Friday, and it is a kind of a recap of what happened in Washington that week, and got pictures with it, and all we need is an email address. But if you press *6, you can sign up for that email, get our newsletter every Friday afternoon. But again, if you want to ask a question tonight to jump into the queue, it's simply by pressing *3. So let's, while we still attract a number of callers on the phone, I want to take just a minute to begin this evening by talking about the latest breaking news here in Washington. And, there's been a lot of talk about, of course, the Trump administration is getting its feet on the ground, executive orders, and beginning to go through that process of standing up the administration. We still have the Senate doing a number of Senate-confirmed nominations for various activities. Tulsi Gabbard, as an example, was confirmed today by the Senate as the Director of National Intelligence. She's a former colleague of mine here in the House. She was a Democrat, but found favor with President Trump and now is the DNI, and confirmed just a few hours ago. The big news here today, though, is the fact that finally, after weeks and weeks of discussions and meetings and all kinds of get-togethers, we have finally laid out a budget framework, a budget resolution framework that will unlock what we refer to in Washington speak as a reconciliation process. Now, I'm not going to begin to try to educate all of you on exactly what reconciliation is, but every year when you do a budget resolution, you have the opportunity to deal with matters of revenues or expense or debt without having to be confronted with a filibuster in the Senate. Of course, anything we do in the House under a rule requires a simple majority of votes. So on most everything that we might do that has any bit of controversy to it, it only takes 218 votes in the House. But it's not like that in the Senate. In the Senate, because of the rules of the Senate, the minority always has some leverage because of the 60-vote rule on ending a filibuster. But when you do reconciliation, the advantage of it is that it waives the opportunity, or it waives the requirement and denies a filibuster by the minority party. So all it takes is a simple majority or a 50-50 vote in the Senate where the vice president of the governing party, in our case, a Republican, J.D. Vance, can break that tie. So on some very important matters that are difficult to be able to get through a 60-vote filibuster in the Senate, you try to do as much of that as you can under reconciliation. So we know going into the Congress, under President Trump's new administration, that one of the key points that he was going, one of the key promises he made in his campaign was to extend the tax cuts that we enacted back in 2017, also done under reconciliation. Some of those provisions expire at the end of this year, so extending those cuts and hopefully making some of those permanent, much like we did the corporate rate back in 17, is going to be necessary to move those through the House and the Senate and get them signed by the President. Because of the controversial nature of the tax cuts, the fact is we would not have the votes necessary under a normal rulemaking scenario, so we do it under reconciliation. And we've been talking about that. And there, like I say, there have been a ton of meetings and a lot of back and forth with leadership and rank and file members about how to deal with reconciliation. So my friend Jody Arrington, the budget chair, laid down his budget resolution framework today. And I think tomorrow, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, 10 o'clock in the morning? I think 10 o'clock in the morning, our time here tomorrow, 9 o'clock central, the budget committee will meet and mark up that budget document. That will unlock the ability for us to execute a reconciliation strategy. So what happens is, in the budget resolution itself, there are targets given to the relevant agencies that will have something to offer in reconciliation. For example, Tax Writing Committee, Ways and Means, it's all about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 and extending those provisions. That's going to amount to a cost. And the Ways and Means Chairman, Jason Smith, indicated that he needed about $4.7 trillion in that 10-year time frame in order to be able to meet the demands of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. In the budget resolution tomorrow, he will be given a $4.5 trillion amount with which to be able to, effectively keep those tax cuts in play. There will be other provisions in the budget resolution that will be important to understand. Some of those, like military and homeland security, some of those costs will go higher. And then in order to compensate for the higher cost of some of the provisions, like the tax cuts and the border security and so on, we'll have to find cuts in other places in order to meet the goals outlined in the budget resolution. So that's just kind of a quick primer on what the budget resolution is about. It's not a function of law. It is not signed into law, but it does set targets for the relevant agencies to go to work and come up with the changes to their respective programs under their jurisdiction that will either pay for or add additional costs to the budget. And if you want to ask me a question about that, I'll be more than happy to get down a little bit more in detail, but we could talk all night about budget resolutions and reconciliation, but we don't want the program tonight to be dominated only by that. One other note real quick before we go to our calls and take some questions. I have been very adamant that the country is going to run out of money to pay for the functions of government on March 14th. We're operating right now under a continuing resolution, and that CR, as we call it, expires on the 14th day of March. So we have just a little over a month right now to get across the finish line the full year appropriations for FY25. Now, FY25 started back on October 1st, so we're in the fifth month of the fiscal year, and we're still operating on last year's priorities and last year's numbers. This is very dangerous, in my opinion, for the country. If no other reason, because of the impact it has on national security. And I had the Chief of Staff of the Army in my office two nights ago. He stopped by to tell me about some of the impacts that a CR is having on our Army. Anything that we are asking of our Army today that wasn't the case back when we passed the FY24 bills, he can't do because you can't start new programs. And here's a good example. In the last National Defense Authorization Act, we gave our men and women in uniform a raise, and it's a pretty sizable amount of money to cover the people that get these raises. We didn't give the military any additional money because we're operating under the same budget and the same numbers from doggone near 2 years ago. So they're having to pay for those raises. They got to do it by law. They got to pay for it out of high. That means they're taking that money from other programs in order to meet the demands on the pay raise. And it's very dangerous when you start chipping away because we're asking our Army, our Navy, our Air Force, our Marine Corps, we're asking them to do some very important duty in other places around the globe, and we're not giving them the resources with which to be able to execute those, so it's very dangerous for us to continue down this CR path. And I continue to bang the drum here in Washington with leadership. We need to finish our appropriations work. Lastly about that, let me tell you that there's about the better part of a couple of hundred million dollars sitting in the FY25 appropriation bills that benefit the 3rd District of Arkansas. I do not want to see those programs unfunded because we, Congress, can't get our work done. So, and that includes money for Highway 412 going east of I-49 there at Lowell down to 265. It includes tens of millions of dollars to support the new mission down at Fort Smith, the F-35 FMS mission that is now underway. We've got Polish Air Force officers doing training right now at Fort Smith. We have important money scheduled for that. And there's a lot of projects around my district, whether it would be in Rogers or Springdale or Fort Smith or Huntsville or just all across my district. We have several projects that are funded in FY25 if we can finish our work. So I hope that gives you kind of a snapshot of where we are in time. And I will be more than happy to dig down on some of these as we go. All right, let's get to some calls. Remember, *3 if you want to get in the queue, *6 if you want to sign up for our newsletter, and I hope you'll do that. And I think Hillary from Prairie Grove is first up. Hillary, are you there?
Yes, Representative Womack, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for holding this town hall and communicating with your constituency. I wanted to ask, I'm concerned about Elon Musk, a foreigner not elected to his position, leading a team of also unelected people in their teens and 20s, having access to our personal and financial data. Do you support these unelected and in some cases foreign parties accessing our private information? And is anything being done to protect our personal and financial information and interests from misuse or abuse?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. We get a lot of calls about the Doge effort, about Elon Musk, and before he left the team, Vivek Ramaswamy. Let me just say we're early in the process, and let me say it this way: I support from a number of different standpoints. I support the effort that the president has outlined to bring about better government efficiency and to look for ways for our country, beginning with Congress, to hold the bureaucracies that command so much of our tax money, to hold them accountable and to make them more efficient. I don't know of any rational argument that would be against the notion that we should make government as efficient as possible, save as much money as we can, and create a better outcome for the U.S. government. As it concerns Elon Musk, while I support the effort of Doge and the notion that we have a terribly inefficient government at times, that if he has the capacity, without violating the Constitution, without violating established law, to help us uncover a lot of the issues that they're already studying, then I'm going to support that. There will certainly be challenges to it. There will be litigation about whether or not an unelected person, like an Elon Musk or somebody similarly situated, would be offered access to very sensitive matters that affect the country. So, like you, Hillary, I too am concerned about the ability for unelected people appointed through presidential channels to have unfettered, unlimited access to privacy data involving the general public. And if that is the case and remains the case, then I'm sure that is going to be challenged and will be summarily litigated, in terms of whether or not it's even legal or possible. But again, it's very early in the process. We haven't seen the full effects. And some of the things that I've seen the Doge operation uncovering are yielding some pretty staggering results, that funding from this government going out in the forms of grants and other programs is funding a lot of things that are just inconsistent with traditional American values, and the president certainly has the latitude and the authority from the executive branch to call into question some of these expenses. So I think it's important that we be patient with the program. We can be concerned about it, and I share some of these concerns, but before we just absolutely bring it to a halt, I think we need to let those folks operate and then at the appropriate time make sure that there's accountability for particularly private information that we don't want in the hands of people who don't have, if you will, the vote of and the legal authority, the constitutional authority that our Constitution provides. All right. Tony from Little Flock.
How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Pretty good. I miss the radio station, you know. I used to listen to that quite a bit. But and I was on a town hall with Bart Hester's office the other night. Didn't get in on the cube soon enough. But question was, during the campaign, Trump talked about something that just kind of blew a lot of people out of the water. It's about the no federal income tax on Social Security. And will he have to, can he do that through executive order, or does he have to do it through the House and the Senate?
Right. Well, it's a great question. Let's talk about that. That is a campaign promise made by the president. Whether or not he will be successful at it remains to be determined. The short answer to your question is he can't do that unilaterally. Social Security is a matter of law. It will take an act of Congress to change the Social Security rules, and as it concerns taxation, that brings into play a lot of different considerations. But you heard me talking early about reconciliation. Reconciliation rules do not allow for a change in the program of Social Security. In other words, you can't use expedited procedures in the Senate, read 50 votes, in order to be able to enact changes to the Social Security program. You can do it for other things, any other item, but you can't use reconciliation to deal with Social Security. That is just a rule of a rule of law. Now, if the president is going to be successful in eliminating the tax on Social Security, it's going to have to be done in some other fashion than under reconciliation. That would mean that a bill would have to be brought before the House and the Senate and agreed to, signed, and then presented to the president and signed into law. As you know, a lot of people that earn Social Security benefits don't have to pay federal taxes because that's basically their only source of income. But the rules of Social Security provide, and this goes all the way back to, I think, the last change of 1983. My staff is here. They can correct me on that. When we started making Social Security taxable after you have achieved income greater than your Social Security amount by continuing to work in other jobs and have other earned income, and then at a certain point in time, a certain percentage of your Social Security is then subject to taxation. I know this as a Social Security recipient because of my income level. I think 85% of my Social Security is indeed taxable. So, but the president's not going to be able to deliver on that promise, at least anytime real soon, because it won't be done during reconciliation, and it'll take an act of Congress to do it. Now, what the president does want to do, and can under reconciliation, he wants to remove the tax on TIFs, and that's been an ongoing promise that he made during his campaign. And he also wants to enhance some border security measures, spend a little money on those. And what was the other tax provision, Nick? Overtime. Yeah, on overtime pay. Now, that one would be a little more difficult to deal with, in my opinion, separating overtime pay from regular pay and how that would be done at a local business. But tax on tips, tax on overtime, that's going to add to that cost. If you remember what I said about reconciliation, Jason Smith at Ways and Means said in order to continue with the 2017 tax cuts as they are, he was going to need $4.7 trillion over the 10-year window to be able to execute that program. That did not include, to my understanding, overtime and tips. So if he's going to add overtime and tips to that measure, then he's going to need more bandwidth, if you will, more resources with which more cuts to other programs to be able to pay for the additional cost. So I hope that very clears things up.
Where does the state of Arkansas, do they tax the person on their Social Security earnings?
I don't think Arkansas is taxing Social Security benefits, but there is a federal tax levy against certain benefits, not all, certain benefits after you have earned a certain amount of income over that threshold.
Okay, so the that's the ones that have the purse strings to the expenditures.
Say that again. I missed you.
I said since you're in the U.S. House of Representatives, doesn't the House more or less have the purse strings of the money expenditures that are going on in the U.S.?
Yes, you would be right. So all matters of taxation originate in the House, in the Ways and Means Committee.
You're talking about the reconciliation. If you guys, so you can answer the question, on this USAID thing that they just uncovered, did you guys not even know about this?
Well, first of all, it's not part of reconciliation. USAID is under attack by the DOGE effort because they've uncovered where some of these monies go. Well, here's the deal about USAID. Some of what USAID does is really good. And humanitarian efforts, giving our country some leverage in some trouble spots around the world where we actually need leverage. And then some of what USAID has done has been a little bit, in fact, a lot over the top, the way they have allocated some of these funds through non-governmental or NGOs, non-governmental organizations. I think the ultimate question is going to be on USAID, do you throw the baby out with the bathwater? In other words, do you cancel a program, USAID, and do away with all of what USAID does, and have nothing there, save that money, or do you better refine what USAID does with the money that they have that's appropriated to them and have a better control over where that money is going and for what purpose? So if that money is going out from USAID to some organization for some crazy, nonsensical purpose and we're just wasting taxpayer money, those are the kinds of things I think DOGE and Elon are going after. And I support them in that effort. But I do not support just throwing, as I say, the baby out with the bathwater on USAID. All right, next question. Let's go to David from Elm Springs.
Congressman, thank you for your service. I'm a voter who voted for you. I'm an independent conservative. but I like your stance on most things. I referenced the last conversation. I don't remember hearing anyone in Congress complaining when Biden was illegally adding illegal immigrants to Social Security. And that was an amendment to Social Security. It shouldn't have happened. It's wrong for Trump to propose what he is. It was wrong for Biden to propose that. And I think Biden, I think Trump has already offered a couple of good ways to return that tax revenue. Anyway, my question to you is, will you support all Trump's nominees? Everyone I know does.
Okay, David, thanks for the call. I want to be clear. The short answer is yes. I'm going to support the nominees of the president because it's his prerogative to be able to name the people that he wants to serve in various capacities. I do not have a vote on that. That is not a vote that happens in the House. The Constitution provides that all of those nominations that have to have confirmation are done by the Senate. So I frequently talk about the fact that the Senate has a big HR component to it. They are the people. Tom Cotton, John Bozeman, and the other 98 senators that represent the states in this country are the people who have the authority to either vote a nominee up or down. Now, having said that, I don't think there's any question that you could take a given nominee that has maybe a little bit of a controversial stand on something, and we could nitpick all day long something that we may not agree with them on. But at the end of the day, I served with Tulsi Gabbard at DNI, or not at DNI, but in the House, and now she's going to be the Director of National Intelligence. The fact that she got Senate confirmed today, whether I would like her or not. Now, when she was in the House, she was a Democrat, and we didn't jee-haw too much for obvious reasons. But the fact that she's going to be running the intelligence community, it is vitally important that I, as a member of Congress, work very closely with Director Tulsi to make sure that the issues that impact her business, which I would argue are some of the most sensitive that we have, that she has to have my undivided and unequivocal support, and I plan to do that. And all of the others are the same way. Now, most of the nominees, 100%, not a worry in the world. And every once in a while, there will be somebody nominated that I might have a few issues with, but again, it's only an opinion. It is not a vote. I will tell you this before we leave the subject. When he nominated Matt Gaetz, my former colleague in the House, to run the Department of Justice, that was a non-swimmer with me. I happen to know Matt Gaetz personally. I didn't think Matt Gaetz was qualified, and I didn't think Matt Gaetz had done enough to earn, a position like that in the federal government. Now, obviously, he stepped aside because he knew that he read the tea leaves. He wasn't going to get confirmed. And so he did the right thing and just took himself out of consideration. But all the others, I think we're going to be just fine with. All right, what's next? We got another one? Oh, we got a poll question? Where is that? Got my comms director in here. Oh, where do you want me to do that poll? We got a poll question. We need your help. All right, here it is. President Trump, this is our poll question for the night. We're only going to do one. President Trump recently suggested that the U.S. should annex Canada and effectively make it the 51st state, I guess primarily to gain access to the country's critical minerals. So here's my question for you tonight, and we'll announce the results once we have them tabulated. Do you think Canada should become America's 51st state? Do you think we ought to add a star on Old Glory for Canada and make it the 51st state? If you believe it should, press 1 for yes. If you think Canada should remain a sovereign nation north of our border, Press 2 for no. So yes or no, do you think Canada should become our 51st state? All right, Chase from Centerton, are you there?
Hi, yeah, thank you for your time. My question, I don't know if you have it in front of you or not, but essentially is I work for the VA. Obviously, there's a lot up in the air for any government agency right now, and it is concerning that we are 5 months, you know, coming up on halfway through the next fiscal year and still haven't had any resolution to the budget. And the VA is funded 2 years at a time. It's pretty concerning to be nearly a quarter of the way through that funding period without any resolution. Can you explain some of the holdups on...
Chase, where do I start?
That's probably a very big, broad question. I don't get to read in on a whole lot of this. I work, and then I come home, and I have a whole family, and don't get to commit as much of my time to that as I would like to or probably should.
Well, Chase, you're asking one of the right people because I happen to be an appropriator, and it's our job to fund the government. That's the discretionary side of government. And just so I can be clear with everybody listening tonight that, like you, has other things to worry about than dealing in all these budgetary matters, we have there are two sides to government outlays. There's what we call discretionary spending, which is about a third of total spending, and it's national security and cancer research and keeping the lights on at the Capitol, national parks, and I mean on and on and on. Most of the programs that benefit, that people rely on, that I represent and across this country, are most impacted by what we do on the discretionary side of the spending ledger. The other side of the ledger is what we call mandatory spending, and those are outlays that pay for Social Security benefits and Social Security disability and Medicare, Medicaid, and then there's another growing piece of that mandatory spending called net interest on the debt, and that's what we have to pay annually to service a $36 trillion debt that's going up even as we speak. So your question is, what's holding this up? Well, the way it's supposed to work is the House and the Senate do budgets. They kick out what we call 302A, top-line numbers, for us to spend on discretionary programs. And then the 12 different subcommittees of appropriations gather, meet, and then carve out their particular sub-allocations that pays for the things under their umbrella. Like in my case, I chair the subcommittee in the House on transportation and housing. So all matters of transportation, that's surface transportation, aviation, FAA, some maritime, all of those transportation matters, I write the budget to execute the programs that pay for those transportation matters. And then there's some highway trust fund money that we also allocate that goes out for similar purposes. I also have housing. So HUD, all the HUD programs fall under my jurisdiction. And then every single outlay on the discretionary side has it comes out of a certain subcommittee. Well, since we're not doing budgets, we don't get these top-line numbers that we can write our bills to, and we end up going later and later in the year to actually find a way to do these appropriation bills. So we finally, I think in about July, got all of our work done in the House, and the Senate didn't do anything. They sat on their hands. So we didn't have an approved and agreed-to appropriation strategy. So that meant that at the end of September, we were going to lapse in funding, and we passed what we call a continuing resolution, which is not based on current issues and current funding. It's based on the year before. So we're operating today essentially on the fiscal year 24 totals and the priorities that now date back the better part of a couple of years. So that was in September. So we hit the ground, and when the speaker said we need to do this, we agreed. We're running out of time. And we set the expiration deadline to December, right before Christmas, December 20th, I think. And then we got into December, and we still hadn't finished our work, and so we had to push another continuing resolution to March 14th. So the reason we don't have funding for these various departments to include the Veterans Administration is because Congress hasn't been able to get its act together and pass these appropriation bills. And now, because we're so consumed about reconciliation and the tax cuts and border and energy, because of all the things that we're trying to do that were promises made by the Trump administration, we've somehow forgotten that we still have to fund the government come March 14th. And so it's either going to be one of two things, actually one of three things. We're either going to finish our appropriations work, which is looking doubtful, that is, pass the FY25 numbers, or we'll do another continuing resolution, maybe for the remainder of the fiscal year, terrible outcome, and even worse than that, on March 14th, we could effectively cause a government shutdown. Now, I don't like shutdowns. I don't like CRs. I'm ready to execute my work as the subcommittee chairman on transportation and housing, as I know the rest of my fellow appropriators are on their respective areas. We are ready to go to work to finish this appropriation work. And so for the person that you have that works in the federal government at the VA, I promise you, it's not because we're not willing to do our job. It's because we can't get leadership to find the ability to capture agreement between the House and the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, so we can put this to bed once and for all. Remember, if you want to get the queue tonight, *3. If you want to sign up for our newsletter, it's *6. John from Greenwood.
Thank you, Congressman. Hey, and you touched on USAID earlier, and I wanted to ask a question, because when the news started breaking that DOGE was going to shut down USAID, I went and looked and Googled how much rice does USAID buy every year? How much soybean? How much corn? And it's in excess of $4 billion annually to feed to third world countries. And some of that has come from Arkansas farmers.
Yeah.
And sure. What are you and the rest of the Arkansas delegation doing to protect Arkansas farmers and Arkansas ranchers who are going to suffer due to the work of DOGE?
Well, just remember what I said earlier. There's some of the things involving USAID that I totally agree with. There are some outlays from USAID that are inconsistent with what I believe our country should be doing. But there are other things that our USAID funds go for that are exactly down the in the category that you speak of. So USAID cuts, how does it impact Arkansas farmers? Well, look, if we're not going to be shipping food aid to some of these trouble spots, and that's the leverage that we try to have with people when we're helping feed some really hungry people in very troubled spots around the world, it will come back and impact Arkansas farmers, unless we find a market for those goods that, instead of going out through USAID, instead are being utilized in a different fashion that maybe feed Americans. But I do know that if you just basically throw the baby out with bathwater, as I categorized it earlier, there will be impacts. But let's remind ourselves, it's early in this game. USAID does some really good things. They do some really poor things, and I think what President Trump is trying to do is find an equilibrium there where we can justify the expense that we make and use that leverage to our benefit, bring about better security around the globe so we're not having to, fight a lot of other people and other trouble spots. And just remember this, and I say this a lot, and I mean it. Remember, where the U.S., unplugs, you can expect that China's going to come in behind us and plug in. And
yes, sir.
There are too many places around the globe where it's important that the U.S. has a presence and has leverage with governments. Because I can tell you, China is doing everything it can as our biggest pacing adversary to find leverage and build the relationships and use their money to create people that are dependent on them that one day down the road could upset the world order and cause us to be fighting some avoidable battles of the future. It's a much deeper subject, but that's how I feel. I think we got to be careful. Not everything the federal government does is bad, but we certainly ought to be looking at the things that we do that we can change, save money, and some of this stuff, if we're not going to pay, if USAID is not going to have money to pay a given country for some crazy, nonsensical program, that's money we could use to, better equip ourselves with another country that's friendly to us, that deserves to have a little bit more attention than maybe what they presently get. All right, here are poll results. 76% of you said no to Canada becoming the 51st state. 24% said yes. So it's 3-1, 76 to 24. All right, let's go to Catherine from Fayetteville.
Hello, Congressman Womack. I really appreciate you coming on tonight, and I want to thank you and particularly Kyle Weaver for obtaining funds for the Lake Wellington Recreation Area to refurbish the water and wastewater systems there. That's a big thumbs up for you. It took about 5 years to get that done, but it's done. I guess the money is coming this way, but hadn't been received yet. I'd like to know what else we can do to get funds to really bring that recreation area up to snuff, up to current standards for camping and biking and people using that area in Northwest Arkansas. It's a beautiful area and really deserves to be historically preserved.
All right, Catherine, that's a great question. Thank you for bringing it up. Catherine, tell this audience that is tuned in tonight why Lake Wellington? I mean, I consider it to be one of the Northwest Arkansas treasures, but that doggone recreation area has been closed, right?
Yes, it's been closed for 5 years, purportedly due to no water systems being available. But, people can still go out there and swim and use the lake and enjoy the trails and this, that, and the other and look at the birds and all of that stuff. It is a treasure. It's an urban forest that is only 13 miles from Fayetteville, 13 miles from Siloam Springs, and with the growth of our area, it's going to be really an all-inclusive urban forest. It's
so what Catherine's talking about is an area right smack dab in the middle of Northwest Arkansas that has been closed, and we have just not had the ability to enjoy that recreational opportunity. And the reason it was closed was because we didn't have potable water, we didn't have the proper wastewater treatment. It was basically an infrastructure issue. Now, in the appropriations process, we have the ability to identify projects in our respective districts under certain categories that we can, instead of asking the bureaucracy to give us consideration, that members of Congress have the ability to pinpoint some of these programs through what we call community project funding. That's the old earmark program. And now we've limited the scale of it. We can only do so many, up to a certain amount of money, and they have to be eligible in a given title, and not everything is eligible. But in this particular case, when we were confronted with the challenges facing Lake Wellington, I just simply asked the question, as I should, what can I do to get Lake Wellington opened? And some of the majority of the issues were in the area of infrastructure, notably water, wastewater, and that was an area that qualified under our CPF program. So in the FY24 budget that we're on right now, we got a community project funding grant of just under $5 million for the purpose of fixing the infrastructure issue at Lake Weddington. And once those funds flow and that work is completed, we'll have Lake Weddington open, and that rec center will be thriving once again. But it just simply wasn't going to happen because it wasn't a priority of our region or the country until we were able to get this community project funding directed for that particular purpose. So, Catherine, thanks for bringing that up. And we're excited about what's going to happen at Lake Weddington. It can't happen soon enough, and I hope people will recognize that the reason it's going to happen is because we made it a priority in that FY24 budget process. All right, Dee from Fort Smith.
Hello, Congressman. Good evening. Good evening, Congressman. It's great to visit with you. Always appreciate the time you make for your constituents. Had the opportunity to visit with you when I was school board here in Fort Smith a few years ago, and you've always been a great friend to our district. We appreciate that.
Yeah, you lost your superintendent recently.
Sadly, yeah. Yes, we did. We did. I'm reaching out to you tonight as a mom, though, not my school board had at all, just as a citizen and a mom. And my son is a two-time cancer survivor. He recently had a stem cell transplant at Arkansas Children's Hospital. Sir, I know that you know the importance of UAMS for our state, the importance of Arkansas Children's Hospital for our state, and even the region and some of the surrounding states. And so I urge you, sir, if there's an opportunity to advocate with the cuts in research funding for the NIH, that you keep this in mind. And again, I know the theme, the baby with the bathwater. I think it's important, historically cancer research, especially for children, has not, it's got universal support, sir. And, I feel like that this is just kind of, overreach and getting into an area that that harms our Kansans directly.
Well, so Dean, let's talk about NIH for just a minute. I don't know if you know this or not, but recently I had the former NIH director. She was NIH director at the time, Monica Bertinelli. She came down to my district. We spent some time in Northwest Arkansas, but we also came down to Fort Smith. She toured the AHAC and some of the other facilities down there. And I did that for a reason, and that is because I'm a believer in NIH. NIH is saving lives. I'm a big fan of biomedical research. I'm adamant about us robustly funding NIH. If we don't robustly fund NIH, people die. It's as simple as that. And I am I'm a huge fan. I have always stood with NIH, and I've always stood with CDC. I think I want to be clear, though, what DOGE is looking at is not necessarily the money that NIH provides that goes toward toward science and toward research and discovery, those kinds of things. What they have done, and I'll have a little better feel for this here in a few days, they have attacked this administrative, Nick, I don't know what we call it. It's an administrative thing. The what? It's the indirect cost. So wherever there is research going on, say at a UAMS or a Fort Smith or a Fayetteville, wherever there's research going on, there is a set-aside in that grant for more or less administrative expense, and it's just a kind of a set-aside for those purposes. And there is a formula that can be used that can demonstrate, and I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about that you might be able to relate to, but it's a limit as to what you can use for administrative purposes. And in the case of a place like the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, as an example, They recognize that in order to effectively do this research, some of the money that is allocated needs to be able to compensate for the facility, for the lab, you know, for the testing, for the, you know, the administrative functions of that. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to limit how much of that money goes for that purpose so that we can turn loose more money for the effective research that does save lives and improve everyday outcomes. So let's be careful not to just suggest that we're taking away NIH's ability to do its job. I believe NIH ought to be funded at a higher level. I have been to the NIH up at Bethesda. I've seen the work, and people's lives are being spared as a result of some of this terrific research. But remember, most of the money that comes out of NIH is not coming out of Bethesda. It's coming out of the NIH account that goes to universities all across our country and researchers and investigators that are on the cutting edge of looking for the discoveries that are going to enhance the public health. And that's why NIH is so important to me. And when Monica came to town, she demonstrated and acknowledged some of the great work that we're doing right here in Northwest Arkansas. All right, got it real quickly. From Ralph in Berryville. Let's go to Carroll County. Ralph, are you there?
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. God bless. Hey, I'm an over-the-road truck driver, and ever since these ELDs come out, there's been less and less parking for semis. Or is the Department of Transportation going to open any of these rest areas back up that they've closed?
Well, man, Ralph, is that a timely question? You heard me talking earlier about the FY25 appropriation bill. I have heard from my trucking community about truck parking so much that when I wrote the FY25 THUD bill, I started a new program. I know sometimes people think, well, we don't need any more new programs. Well, in this case, I believe it's warranted. I put $200 million in my bill for the Department of Transportation to do some pilot programs around the country dedicated to this specific purpose, and that's truck parking. Now, as you can imagine, the trucking industry is all in on this. They support me. Now, the Senate didn't put a dime in their bill for my effort, and when we go to conference with the Senate, it is my plan and my expectation to educate those senators on the need for this truck parking project. And if successful, it could be expanded, and we could do something that could improve the safety and take care of the people that are delivering the vast majority of the items that we consume on an everyday basis, because this stuff is coming to us via truckload. And at night, if you want to just check me out on this, and you know this, Ralph, because you've seen it. You've had to experience it. When you run out of time and you got to park that rig, you just can't put them everywhere. There's not enough Walmart parking lots in the country to handle the truckload when it has to shut down for a certain period of time. And where do they find themselves? Ralph, where do they park? They park on the shoulders.
On the shoulders, on the ramps.
Exit ramps, yep. And so this is what we're trying to do, and I'm trying to...
Because a lot of places don't want trucks to park.
Oh, absolutely. I get that. But don't you think that this is a worthwhile effort to try to put some seed money to the DOT so that they could examine where some of these issues are and bring some relief to this chronic problem?
Yes, sir.
So that's the latest on that, and I hope that I can be successful in getting an FY25 bill done, because that's where that money is right now. And if we don't get an FY25 bill done, we're going to have to wait another year. And I think it's time that we act, and act pretty quickly. I know we're going to run out of time. Got another one, Nick? All right, our next question.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Ralph. Appreciate it. Let's go last question, and this is Donna from Rogers. Hey, Donna. Are you there? Hello, Donna. Is she there? Okay, I can't hear her. Donna, are you there? Hello? All right, the note I'm handed was a question about Kermit. Is that right? All right, so let me ask. Kermit is my dad, the colonel. And, you know, last July 1st, he shut down his radio station, KURM, sold his cattle, and he's at home. He's in Springdale, Arkansas, just turned 90 in September. And he's doing well. Kermit is doing, in fact, he may even be on this call tonight. I don't know. He may have taken it. And I get asked every day about the colonel. And let me tell you, he's doing fine. He's just not very busy. He watches a lot of C-SPAN, and when he sees something or hears something that he doesn't agree with, he calls me. And I just enjoy talking to him all the time. We miss the radio station. I miss his talk shows, and I miss when I drive into town from over in Old Town, Virginia, and come into D.C. from my condo, I'm crossing the 14th Street Bridge, I'm listening to Kerm online. When I'm at home, 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm punching up the Party Line program. Those are the kinds of things that I did for years and years and years, and now we can't do those anymore. But from a health perspective, at age 90, he's doing very well. One more thing about Kermit. Those of you that ever listened to him much, you knew that once upon a time, he broadcast the junior college basketball games in Moberly, Missouri for a number of years, recruited a lot of great players out of Moberly, out of Savannah, Georgia, and Charleston, South Carolina that came to Moberly. And next weekend, the 21st and 22nd, the Colonel is going to be inducted into the Moberly Junior College Hall of Fame. And it's about time that happened, and I spent some time this week with the Board of Trustees of the Moberly Area Community College. They were here for Community College Day, and thank them profusely for at least fixing something that, in my opinion, was long overdue. Okay, we got to make a closing statement. We're almost out of time. And, hey, folks, I wanted to get this done in time for you to flip over to what channel are the Hogs on tonight. I think it may be on ESPN, but the Hogs are going to play LSU tonight. And here in just a couple of minutes from Bud Walton Arena, and I wanted to get off of here in time so you could watch that ball game. If we didn't get to you tonight, please stay on the call, and at the end of this call, you'll have an opportunity to leave a message. As always, I invite your views. We thank you so much for taking your time to join the call. Stay on the call. Leave a message after we finish. We will host town halls periodically, so watch our social media or sign up for our newsletter, and we'll try to maintain communication with you so you know when the next one is coming up. While passing bills is very important, my main focus is on constituent service. My local number in Northwest Arkansas, if you have a constituent service need, you call 479-464-0446. And if you ever need assistance, you can send me an email through my website. Again, after the call, stay on the line to leave a message if you want to do that. But in the meantime, I want to thank you. Thank you for joining us tonight. And thank you from the bottom of my heart for the honor and privilege of serving you in the U.S. Congress. Good night, everybody.